Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention to poisons now, including how healthcare professionals manage it and what to do if you ingest some. Back with us, Ryan Feldman. He's a toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, an emergency medicine pharmacist, and an assistant professor of pharmacy and emerging medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also the host of The Poison Lab. It's a podcast. I was listening to one of the podcasts this morning. He discusses on The Poison Lab the history, the science, and medical management of harmful chemicals and toxins. So as we talk with Ryan, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have for our toxicologist and poison expert? Have you ever accidentally taken too much medicine and gotten sick? Or have you accidentally ingested a chemical, maybe while cleaning? What did you do? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Ryan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to be back.
As a toxicologist, you've studied poisons and of course reactions to chemicals for years, and have helped people calling the Wisconsin Poison Center hotline. How does somebody in your position define what a poison is?
Yeah. Well, when I say the word poison, a lot of people probably conjure up ideas of cyanide or pills slipped into a drink, but really, a poison can be anything. So all the way back in the year 1500, a Swiss physician named Paracelsus came up with the term, poisons are in everything, and the dose alone determines what a poison is. And that gets shortened a lot to the dose makes the poison, which I think everybody knows. So really any chemical, and even things you might think of that you use in everyday life, like water or salt, can be poisonous if they're taken in a dose that leads to harmful effects on the system or kind of changes the way your biology works. So we're really surrounded by poisons, since almost anything can be a poison.
Yeah, I was thinking back to some runners, for example, at events and meets that drank too much water and had a not very good effect from it.
Exactly. In fact, there was long ago a story about a radio show that did a challenge where you had to drink as much water as you could in a short amount of time, and it actually led to someone becoming very, very sick because it can affect your sodium level. So just about anything can be a poison. It's all about the dose.
Yeah. You host an interesting podcast called The Poison Lab, and maybe before we take calls, what do you talk about on the podcast? Visit about that a little.
Yeah, so the podcast is an outlet for me to explore a lot of these different poisoning topics without anyone's life or limb needing to be on the line. These topics are pretty fascinating. There's a lot of history. There's a lot of interesting medical management related to things. But when you're actually dealing with a patient who is sick in front of you, you don't get the time to sit down and slowly think about all of the different things going on. And you have to take quick action to make sure that patient's going to be okay. So the podcast is just another outlet where I get to do probably my, you know, taking care of poison patients is maybe my second favorite thing. My first favorite thing is talking about poisons, because, you know, it's you get all the fascinating stuff, but it's a little bit lower stress in the moment. So we talk about a lot of different topics, poisoning outbreaks. One of my most recent episodes, we interviewed a whole team of healthcare providers who took care of a mass poisoning outbreak in Ontario, Canada. It's just really cool to hear about people's different perspectives and how these different types of poisons are managed.
Nick in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Nick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Actually, I got a story for you. And I love black labs. I love all labs, but they're all stupid dogs. They're dorks. And I had a mouse problem in the garage, so I stuck a chunk of mouse poison way underneath the workbench because he would never know it's there. and he got into the garage, and I looked into there, and sure enough, there it was. It was gone. So we called the vet because we were freaking out. She said, give him a teaspoon of hydrogen peroxide. And didn't that idiot, he ate the whole thing. He swallowed it in one big gulp, and the hydrogen peroxide made him puke, and he puked up the whole chunk, and he's 9 years old now, and no side effects, but he's still an idiot, so.
I'm still an idiot, Nick. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, hydrogen peroxide, yeah, if you drink some of that, you're going to puke it up.
You know, that's a really interesting story, and it kind of brings up an interesting point. Inducing vomiting is something that in humans we almost never recommend anymore because the risk of throwing up and choking on it is so great. Now, in dogs, it's a different story because their stomach and their airway, or their esophagus and their airway, are horizontal. So throwing up for a dog is really easy. They just comes right out. But in a human, our esophagus and our airway are vertical. When you throw up, it kind of comes back down. We get really worried about that in humans, but for pets, it's a really common intervention to give them peroxide to throw up. In humans, we rarely do that anymore.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I'm thinking about this. They're ingesting, okay, eating something. You can certainly get poisoned that way, but I'm thinking that there'd be other ways you could get poison into your system.
Yeah, there certainly are. In fact, one of our most common calls that comes through a poison center is about toxic gases that are accidentally made at home. If you combine bleach, which is hypochlorite, with an acid, it releases the chlorine in that bleach and you get chlorine gas. So that is something that people can inhale. It dissolves into the mucous membranes of the lungs and the eyes and causes irritation. It can really be pretty bad if you don't get out of there quick, which most people do. But we get lots of calls about gas inhalations. Sometimes injectable medications start to cause problems. There are certain rare things that if they get on the skin, they can be a problem. Certainly chemicals that can cause burns. It's not just swallowing a medicine or a poison that is the issue. You can get exposed in all sorts of ways.
Why the heck would anybody mix bleach and an acid to begin with?
it's usually vinegar that people are mixing it with, which is acidic. And people think they're creating a nice extra cleaning cocktail, and they don't realize what they're doing. And then suddenly their eyes start to sting or they start to have trouble breathing. And that's exactly when you should get out of that room and give a call to a poison center.
Why? Well, I'm glad we brought that up because there's probably people that have tried that and maybe even thought about it but didn't do it, and now you're saying don't do it.
Larry, your question of why is one of the reasons I get into poisoning in the first place, because so many times I hear about what just happened and I just go, why? But hey, we all make mistakes in life, and sometimes something happens and you're not sure why that, or you gave a dose of medicine to your kid and so did mom 2 hours later, and suddenly we're like, uh-oh, we ran into problems. So things happen in life for many reasons, but we have people here to help with it.
Well, what happens? Let's go through what happens. So somebody, you've answered many, many hotline questions, I'm sure, from people who would call in after they ingested something they shouldn't have, or maybe their child has. Walk us through what you do when you get a call on the poison hotline.
Yeah. So for many years, I worked as a specialist in poison information. That's the person who answers the phone at the poison center. And this I like to think of as a combination of mad scientist / 911 dispatcher / healthcare professional. They are really, if you get a chance to talk to someone who works that hotline, they're going to have stories for you. But basically, it's a free public access line that absolutely anyone can call if they're worried about anything. You don't even have to be poisoned if you just have an informational question. But when you call that hotline, you're going to get somebody who is going to help you assess the situation. Maybe you took a bite of a mushroom, or you're inhaling some gas from mixing cleaners, or you double-dosed your medication, or maybe you took a whole bottle of your medication in self-harm. These are people, trained medical experts, who are going to help assess the situation, decide if it's dangerous or not, get you linked up with the right healthcare if you need it. And then they actually tell those healthcare providers how to treat the poisoning. They consult on how to manage it. It's totally confidential. And this is really, I think, an incredible service that in the world of today, where there's a lot of crumbling infrastructure in terms of public health and safety, this is a really useful public health service that absolutely anyone can access with millions of dollars of medical training on the other side.
We're going to stay with Ryan Feldman into the next half hour of our show. And I hope you'll stay with us. And Sherry and LaCrosse, we'll get to you after we take a look at the news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the science, the management, and the history of poisons with our guest Ryan Feldman, back with us, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center and host of the podcast called The Poison Lab. It explores the nature of his work. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. Sherry in La Crosse has been waiting a bit here. Let's go to see what's on her mind. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. It's funny because when I think of poisoning, I think about our neighbor when I was a kid. I'm 60, and he was going to get his milk tank really, really clean. So he mixed the bleach and other soap and nearly died and lived with severe lung damage for the rest of his life. And I remember my dad running over there because his wife had found him. And she's lucky she found him when she did.
Wow.
So it can happen. It kind of, part of your head just is like extra clean. But you know, obviously, I learned that lesson pretty young, but he didn't.
Sherry, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's your answer for why, Larry.
Yeah.
People want clean tanks, and it's more common than you think, and it is really can be a dangerous mix-up. So keeping those cleaners separate is very, very wise.
Vivian in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
There is something that I witnessed working in the Green Bay area for three different school districts over 20 years, 25 years or so. And I wondered if anyone had studied the consequences of unused medications being flushed, because that was the practice in the school. At the end of the year, if parents did not pick up prescribed medications after a certain period of time, we on the staff were directed to flush them. And when I mentioned that to a principal, he'd never heard that. So, and they talk about so many illnesses originating in childhood, like, you know, no fluoride now. But has anyone gone back to thinking about how much Ritalin was flushed back then?
That is an interesting question. There are certain, actually, drugs that the DEA recommends that you flush just due to the fact that they're going to be safer being disposed of in the waste system than potentially available in the hands of other people. A lot of those are narcotic medications. Another thing to consider here is when you take a medicine by mouth, your body processes it a little bit, but some of that medicine is also excreted in your urine, and that urine is flushed. So whether you're flushing the tablet or you're putting it through yourself and then flushing it, it does get into the wastewater system. Now, we have wastewater treatment facilities that can help with preventing those things from getting back into general circulation, but it's an interesting idea. And there actually have been some studies of fish in water where they found high levels of the sedative or anxiety medication, benzodiazepines. And they found that these fish take riskier actions because they're exposed to these medications that relax them. So they're less stressed out all the time. And they tend to hang out closer to predators. So you're certainly on to an interesting idea. I think we have some safeguards in place in most major metropolitan areas. And just because you're not flushing the pill doesn't mean drugs aren't entering the wastewater system as well. But it is a thought. I don't know about Ritalin specifically, but I'm hoping that our wastewater friends, we were just talking about sewage before, maybe they have some ideas about it. I'm hoping they've taken care of some of that problem.
Vivian, thank you very much for calling. Kelly in Dubuque, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, I have two questions. One, we recently had to put our daughter on an iron supplement, and in buying the supplements, I kept reading on all the bottles, in ages 6 and under, this can cause poisoning, so keep out of the hands of children. So I'm kind of wondering what happens after the age of 6. That they tolerate the supplement better, or they're out of the danger zone. And then my next question is what can parents keep on hand at home to help keep our kids safe in case they do ingest something? What's kind of like a good detoxifier or binder to keep in the medicine cabinet?
Those are two fantastic questions. Can I start with the detoxifier first?
Sure.
The answer is nothing. It is the Poison Center phone number and 10 ounces of prevention by keeping medicines up and away and locked in secure cabinets. And that goes for cleaning agents too. 40% of the calls to a poison center are for kids under the age of 5 getting into either medicines, cleaning products, or cosmetic products. There is no universal antidote out there. If you are in a hospital, we might, in certain conditions, give you something called activated charcoal. This is something that will go into the stomach and bind any of that poison that's in the stomach to keep the body from absorbing it. But the dose that we have to give in that scenario is massive. There is over-the-counter activated charcoal. That's like a thousandth of what would be going on here. So I don't want anyone to get that mixed up. This is something that should only be done by a medical professional. And in terms of things like inducing vomiting, we talked about this just a little bit before, but we don't recommend that almost ever, because the risk of throwing up and choking on it is so high. And actually, inducing vomiting can even sometimes push medicines further down through the stomach into the body to get more absorbed. So it's not a recommended practice anymore. And then there's nothing to keep at home to make someone vomit. In fact, there's been some really dangerous cases where parents or even people who ate something themselves have tried to induce vomiting by doing things like drinking salt water or drinking excess water, and it has actually caused that person to die. So we are really careful with that. The biggest thing you can do is prevention. Know where your medicines are and your chemicals. Keep them locked up and away. And then have the Poison Center phone number, 1-800-222-1222.
And wait a second. What's that again? 1-800?
Let's do, yeah, yeah. 1-800-222-1222. And that is going to get you to a medical professional who's an expert in poisoning, who will then assess the situation with you. And a lot of these scenarios are not that dangerous. Most of the kids we get calls about, the vast majority are staying at home and they're going to do just fine. Maybe they'll have an upset tummy, but not much else to worry about. So that's who you should call to help figure out your next steps there. And that's such a good question, because so many people think, well, there's got to be something we can do at home. There's infinite poisons, right? And the treatments for all of them are slightly different. So that's why we want an expert to come in and help you make that decision. And guess what? They're totally free. You just call the Poison Center and they're going to help you out. Now, let's talk about the iron. I think that's a really funny question. My daughter is 4 months old and she had a fever recently, and the ibuprofen says, do not give until 6 months old. And, you know, what happens at, you know, 5 months and 30 days versus 31 days that they suddenly could tolerate it? In truth, many of the medicines that have things on there are okay to be given when a healthcare provider like your pediatrician says, go ahead and do it. Some medicines, there is a very real risk to giving it when they're too young. For example, honey is a common cough suppressant. And honey can be sold over the counter as a cough suppressant, as a medicine. But you can't give it to kids who are less than 1 year of age because they have the risk of getting botulism from the honey. Their immune system isn't developed enough. So that some kids, when they're very young, they don't yet have the enzymes that their body needs to process certain medication. So there's some general safety limits where they say, well, let's not do this until this age because we know it's safe at this age. Oftentimes it is safer below that age, but that's a decision to be made in conjunction with your pediatrician or the healthcare provider prescribing it. Iron specifically, pretty upsetting to the tummy, and certain doses of it might be too large for a kid who is not old enough yet, because young kids, they're pretty small. And it's the milligrams per kilogram, or the dose per weight, that determines the toxicity. So I don't think there's anything specific at 6 years of age, but below that, you probably need to be making the decision with your healthcare provider, if that helps.
All right. There you go, Kelly. Thank you very much for calling. Tom in Manawa, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
How you doing, Larry? I'm wondering about a video that recently you got from a good friend of mine, Sweet Misery. That's a 2005 video about the origins of aspartame and all the different aspects of that and multiple things. I'm just wondering a dosage on something like that. If somebody's going to be drinking diet soda or sweetening their coffee with that, you know, how... Is there any studies that have ever been done on humans that would show that?
That would show a dose at which aspartame is toxic to humans? Is that what we're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I will say, number one, I primarily deal with acute poisoning, which are people overdosing or dealing with an acute exposure. Chronic toxicity from ingesting something over and over and over, slightly different. We do see that sometimes. Aspartame is not something that really lands on my radar all that often, other than when people ask about it causing cancer. I'm not sure if that's what you're pointing towards. And I will be full disclosure, I haven't done a deep dive on aspartame in a long time, but the last time I had looked into it, it seemed to be massive doses that were needed in rats in order to cause cancer. And generally speaking, you can only extrapolate animal data so much when it comes to humans, because we have different enzyme systems and even different cancer risks based off of our cells. But that said, I can't give you a definitive answer because I'm not entirely sure what outcome you want data for. And I don't know that that data is going to exist in humans. It would probably take me a while. I'd have to do some research, and I don't want to give you something wrong.
I was, I had a guest on the show once who's, near the end of the show, she was a cared for dogs, dog care person, and realized that she did not have her gum in her purse, and raced out of the out of the studio because her dog could it. She remembered she'd left it out. And I don't remember what the what's in the gum.
Probably xylitol that she's worried about. The sweeteners in the sugar alcohols like xylitol can be very dangerous for animals, actually. So sugar-free gum or sugar-free sweeteners in dogs specifically has caused some problems because it's very sweet. So, of course, dogs will eat it. And it can actually be very damaging to their livers, not to ours, but to theirs. Just another example of how humans and dogs tend to differ. Now, let me preface this. I'm not a veterinary toxicologist. I don't treat animals.
Yeah.
There is a veterinary toxicology poison helpline that the ASCPA runs. But we do run into it. We get calls about it at the poison center, and we redirect them to that pet poison helpline. But we get plenty of questions about it. And I do run into some problems once in a while. Just working in the tox world.
So under that, if you had a pet, if you just Googled in pet poison hotline, you'll get the number and you can make the call. I'm guessing.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It'll bring, and you could call your vet to, they'll direct you.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just wanted to share an experience I had when I was in high school. I was comparing babysitting war stories with a friend of mine, and she had been babysitting for a family of very young children. They were a kind of notorious on the babysitting circuit for eating anything, and she was not in the kitchen when this kid went into the kitchen and opened the cupboard and got into the cleaning compounds and got them open, filled them, and spilled them on in the area and on himself. And she found him and had no idea whether he'd ingested it or not. And as an immediate response, what she did was she opened his mouth and swiped her finger around the inside of his mouth. And there was no smell of the cleaning compound, so she was pretty confident that he had not ingested anything. And then she followed up with a call to the poison center.
That's great.
I thought it was just a genius way to check and see.
Yeah. This is a really, really common scenario. I mean, many times a day we're getting calls about this exact thing. I got a kid who's got liquid cleaning and powdered cleaning agents all over him. I'm not sure if he ate it or not. And we walk people through how to check the mouth for ulcers or sores that might be indicative, and go through how to see if they can tolerate a sip or a lick of fluid to make sure there's no pain with swallowing. These are the exact things that our poison center specialists walk people through to make sure they didn't ingest something. And usually in these cases, we say the solution to pollution is dilution. We wash them down, get all that stuff off of them, dilute out whatever poison is on their skin or on their clothing, and help dilute out anything they may have swallowed. But that's a perfect example of why a poison center should be called. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Henry in Dodgeville, we'll go to you next. Hi, Henry.
Yeah, just a quick question on mixing water, hydrogen peroxide, and vinegar together to treat algae on decks. Is it safe?
Well, generally speaking, I get most worried when people mix bleach with other compounds, because bleach contains chlorine and it can react with ammonia, vinegar, as well as hydrogen peroxide, and soaps to produce several different compounds. For hydrogen peroxide and vinegar, I'm personally not aware of any toxic gas that it would produce. If you're using it in a well-ventilated area and not noticing any symptoms, I'm not sure I would be that concerned about it. But it's not one I've looked into recently. So it's not the cleaner that I worry about. Without Googling a little bit more, I won't give you a full yes or no. But it's mainly mixing bleach with things that I get primarily worried about.
All right, Henry, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Kevin in La Crescent, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon, maybe. Thanks for taking my call, first of all. Secondly, I have two dogs. One definitely ingested antifreeze. So within a few hours, I took him to the vet, and they gave me, I don't know, five or six large syringes of what they called carbon, I guess. And so he, of course, ate all that too, lovely, or during in whatever sequence you're supposed to give it to them. Then my other dog, I suspected she had also ingested some antifreeze. And so instead of taking her to the vet, which, of course, is very expensive, and I wasn't sure she had, and she didn't seem to have any symptoms, I took some charcoal from my big green egg and crushed it up and put it in some food, and she ate that. I did that a few times and nothing ever happened, but I was wondering if the same kind of charcoal, or if you have any idea about that.
Well, the charcoal is going to be slightly different. Activated charcoal has gone through a lot of processing to make it super absorbent and have a really big surface area. Although all the way back in like the 1920s, they used to say, just give people burnt toast, because it's kind of a similar concept. You know, it's this inert substance that's maybe going to bind. I would say, you know, the treatment for ethylene glycol, generally speaking, charcoal doesn't even work that well for it. Oftentimes, they need other antidotes, but the veterinary world is a little bit different. And with ethylene glycol, sorry, antifreeze, that ethylene glycol is what's in antifreeze. Sometimes you won't know that something is wrong until the kidneys fail. So it wouldn't, if this was recent, you might consider talking to your vet about getting the kidneys checked out. But the charcoals, the carbon that they gave him at the vet was probably a form of activated charcoal, which charcoal is just carbon as well. But there can be some more complexities to these types of cases. So it's probably a good idea. I know it's expensive, but at least calling them to find out if this is something to be very worried about.
Kevin, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Ryan, you're an emergency medicine pharmacist. What does your work entail?
Yeah, so I work in an emergency department as a kind of drug and medication expert. So I'm part of the team who is with you when you show up at the door with a heart attack, stroke, arrhythmia, or anything else. And I help make sure that the right drug for you is going to be given in that scenario. Working with a team of medical doctors, nurses, technicians, just a huge, great team in the emergency departments. And you know, sometimes two people have the same disease, but because of one person having a different past medical history, maybe they have a different way they metabolize drugs or they're on drugs that interact, they would benefit from a different drug for that disease than the other person. So I kind of facilitate all things related to drugs and trying to ensure that everybody has the right medicine for them in an acute emergency.
John wonders, sometimes people can overdose on drugs like even aspirin or Tylenol. What happens when you take too much of an over-the-counter pain medication?
That is such a good question and something people don't often realize. Both aspirin and Tylenol are two really concerning drugs in overdose. Both of them are very safe when taken therapeutically, but Tylenol or acetaminophen is the number two cause of liver transplant in the United States. Oh. If you take more than the amount that you're supposed to take. So you really have to pay attention. It oxidizes, it turns into this nasty metabolite called NAPKE, and that can really hurt the liver. We can actually almost 100% of the time prevent that bad medical outcome from happening if you get into healthcare and we can treat you because we have an amazing antidote for it. But if you don't, unfortunately, it can cause liver damage that ends up leading to liver transplant. So acetaminophen or Tylenol, when taken above the dosing recommendations, that one actually is really dangerous. You got to pay really close attention. And same with aspirin. If that one gets to be too much, it can build up in the system and it causes your blood to acidify, makes you breathe really fast. You get warm. You can have kind of nasty side effects like seizures. We could treat that one too, not as well as Tylenol, but we do. And I think people run into this problem where they think over-the-counter means safe, and that is just not the case. You have to pay attention to those dosing directions. And if you do double dose or you accidentally went outside the dosing protocols, that's the exact thing that a poison center could help you out with and make let you know whether or not you're going to be totally fine or if you should go get checked out so we can prevent something like a liver transplant.
And that phone number, it would be a kind of a handy thing to have available. It's for the Poison Control Center. It's 1-800-222-1222. So lots of twos. Yeah, it's that's a kind of an easier one to remember, Ryan. But I hope you'll come back and be with us again. This is really enlightening, and it's many more people would like to visit with you. So,
I had so much fun. Thank you. I love getting to share some of this information with anyone who's curious.
Yeah, and I'll mention again, if you want to hear some more from Ryan, his podcast is called The Poison Lab, and it explores kind of the nature of his work. Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center. It's great to have him with us, and we will get him back, and we will talk with him again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the Experimental Aircraft Association's annual convention and fly-in. Draws lots of people. I'm Larry Mueller.